he says. Fight it or fuck it. Desire slices through me, pooling heavy in my blood, aching in my lower stomach, pounding in my ears. Hot and heavy and needy. I let go of his wrists and pull his face to me, kissing him hard, grazing him with my teeth. His arms lock around me, his hands grip my hair. The skin around my mouth buzzes. I want to climb up his long, hard body and bruise him. He lifts his head.
I am mad at you. I want you to know.
Likewise.
And you are going to admit what you did to the tracker.
You've got this all planned out, haven't you?
Yes.
He scythes my legs, dropping me on the metal and holding me in place with a knee to the shoulder.
We are going to do this real slow, he says. I want to hear you beg.
His long fingers skim their way up my legs, past the hold-ups. Firm hands unbuckle my thigh holster. He traces a finger down my chest. My back arches. My shoulder blades press the metal. One fingertip. Have a little self-control, woman. I never beg, I say. I held out for 5 hours against Everard during interrogation training. After a while, we lie on our backs, dragging air into our lungs. My heart pounds like I've just run a marathon. I feel boneless, spatchcocked, flattened, fucked. I think about his brother's description. Women just fall at his feet. No fucking wonder.
5 hours, he says. I don't think you lasted 5 minutes. He's not wrong.
I slam an arm down on his smug face. It's all I can manage. He grunts.
If you want to fight, you'll have to give me a minute.
Why do they think you're in Turkmenistan?
I didn't want to be disturbed.
You set this whole thing up just to wring some kind of admission out of me?
Yes.
I don't know why I'm surprised.
I roll my eyes.
The things a guy has to do to get laid.
I've got something for you, he says, sitting up and reaching across into his pile of clothes.
A clink of metal, smooth as silk and heavy, falls onto my bare stomach. The knuckle dusters are a perfect fit. I stretch my hand out, admiring them like another type of woman might admire a ring. They're perfect, I say. How did you get the fit?
I took the mold while you were with me.
I jump up and hit the wall. 1, 2, left jab, right hook. The metal clangs. It leaves a dent in the container a mile wide.
Oh my God, look at that! I'm Superman!
I go again harder, then clutch my chest. I'm gonna need to put a bra on to really go for this. I look down at him. He is laughing.
I think I've died and gone to heaven, he says.
It can be arranged, I say, although I doubt you're going to heaven. I boot him in the ribs.
Get up. Now I've got these, I am going to kick your butt.
I square up to him, and then he is behind me, my wrist across my throat, his arms around my body. Damn it. How does he do that so quick?
I'm gonna kick your butt as soon as I can stop you putting your arms around me.
How's that working out for you? He says, his lips against my ear.
I swing my hips, grinding against him.
Hey, he says.
I feel his concentration waver. I dip and shift, and he goes over my right shoulder and hits the metal with an almighty clang. I kick him again.
In your face!
He takes me out at the knee, and I collapse on top of him.
So what's next?
he says, checking them off on his fingers. You've strangled me, knifed me, and axed me. I don't know. How long have I got?
5 hours. This ship is going to Rotterdam.
I push him back, straddle his ankles, and he looks down his long, hard body at me, his eyes laughing. Slowly, I lower onto him, teasing him with my mouth, moving down inch by inch, grazing with my teeth, pulling back again and again, until his whole body is an iron-hard mass of roped tendons and the thick veins stand out on his neck. He's not laughing now.
Jesus, Winter, what are you doing?
I'm gonna assume that was rhetorical, I say.
Please, he groans. What do you say? Please, Winter.
Not that.
I'm begging.
You can do way better than that. My mouth curves in a smile. He hisses out a long breath.
No way.
I hollow my cheeks, sucking hard and rhythmic. I take him to the edge and stop. He pushes at my shoulders weakly. I swirl my tongue. I do it again, hard and fast, to the edge, and stop. His head thrashes. Hard and fast, to the edge, and stop.
Never.
I can keep this up all night, I say. He groans.
Please, Winter.
Hard and fast, to the edge, and stop.
Say it. I surrender!
The words burst out of him. I lie with my head against his chest, listening to his breathing slow. You know the child that was kidnapped? Was that your brother?
My kid's brother, who you are never going to meet, by the way.
Ah.
And not because you are the long arm of the law. He is way cuter than I am.
I wouldn't say that. His smile fades. I raise my head and look back at him steadily.
Tell me you haven't.
His voice is ominously calm. Yeah. I do that shrug that Leon and the Marquise do. Better to get it out there. He is on his feet in a single move. The dent he puts in the container is far bigger than mine, and that is without knuckle dusters. He stands looking at it for a while, then he goes again. Unreconstructed alpha male, like Attila the Hun, or King Kong on the Empire State Building. I'm sorry, I say when there's a pause. I didn't even know you. It was nothing.
So, like, a one time?
5, if we're counting. You know what 22-year-olds are like. The container rings with the sound of fists on metal. I let the storm rage around me.
I'm going to kill him, he says. No wonder he kept telling me we needed to recruit you.
He glares at me. I think I should probably just kill you right now. I am obviously not going to be good at handling jealousy.
You think? We sit in the open doorway of the container, my legs dangling. The edges sharp against my bare thighs. The sea winds gust, cold against my teeth, against the damp of my bare skin. He pulls his black long-sleeved t-shirt over my head. It's like a tent. His teeth graze my neck. My bare legs kick. Waves crash around us, the rise and fall. I will always associate him with the sound of the sea.
I like you in my t-shirts and nothing else, he says. Not that there isn't a lot to be said for a suit and hold-ups.
He picks up my left wrist and examines it, turning it this way and that in the dim light. He curls each finger under one by one.
How is it?
I will always have a weakness. He puts his arm around me and kisses the top of my head, then my neck, then my face. Then he is lowering me onto my back, his body weight on top of me. He pushes inside me, pinning me to the metal, supporting himself on his elbows. His hands are in my hair, his thumbs rest on my cheeks. His thrusts are hard and slow and vehement, and I know it's goodbye. Say it. His voice is soft. I turn my head away from the look in his eyes. His hands jerk my face upright. Say it. I surrender. I whisper the words. He stands up and dresses quickly, methodically. He leaves me the t-shirt, pulling the body harness over his bare chest. He pulls the straps tight. Overhead, distant at first and getting closer, I can make out the whir of a helicopter. He goes to the door and signals to them. He braces himself for the winch. First and last time of asking, Winter. Come with me? He holds out his hand, his face dark against the dawn. I shake my head. Start running, Alec. He laughs, and then he is gone, the harness winching him up and away into the helicopter. As day breaks, I sit in the doorway of the shipping container, shivering in the sea air, and watching the dock lights of Rotterdam get closer. I tuck my knees up to my chest and pull the t-shirt over them. Wind whips my short hair. My name is Winter, and I am the UK's first line of defence. Epilogue. Hôtel de Police. The words are carved into the stone. It's a modern block, but built in the pale sandstone of Marseille, so it looks okay. An arch cuts through the building. An orange checkpoint arm blocks the way. A massive tricolour flag hangs limp from a flagpole. I take a deep breath and climb the steps. It is bedlam. The Hôtel de Police is also an ordinary police station. I have to wade through the daily detritus of lost phones, street fights, and missing cats to get to the front desk. The duty sergeant picks up the internal phone.
There's a woman here to see you, he says. She won't give her name.
His voice leers. I picture Detective Fresson putting the phone down and hurling himself at the door, four floors up. Will he wait for the lift? I lean up against the wall and check the burner location. It still hasn't moved. They are waiting for the dust to settle. I'm surprised the battery has lasted this long. A second later, Fresson comes hurtling down the stairwell, taking the stairs three at a time, spinning round the bend, his hand braced. I lever myself off the wall by my shoulder blades. His expression falls at the sight of me. A woman in a suit. It's not Snow White. Detective, I hold out my hand. Take a walk with me. He hesitates for a moment, then follows me out through the double doors and down the steps. I put my sunglasses on. Everything I have to tell you is classified, I say. After I've left Detective Fresson, I cross town on foot to the old port. It's a beautiful day. I walk slowly across the main square towards the cafe. The heat is blistering. The air full of roasting meat, Gauloise, bins, coffee. Streets just need a bit of heat to release their sticky, sweaty smells. I pass the fountain. A group of kids hang over the ledge, laughing. A dog scratches, its back leg rotating. I shrug my jacket off and pull up my blouse. The silk sticks to my back. It's too hot for a suit. Cafe tables spill across the pavement, the tablecloths red and white, the chairs wicker. I duck as I go under the awning. A teenager is working the bar, his back to me.
Hello, lover, I say in Snow White's Russian accent. He spins round at the speed of hope. His face falls.
Sorry, he says. Sorry, I thought you were someone else.
I give him a look. You can do better than that, Leon. He stares and stares, and his forehead creases. I smile, more pleased to see him than I expected. You would recognize me if I took my clothes off.
He always did catch on quick. He charges for the end of the bar, rounds the corner, and throws himself on my neck.
What? Ow! He splutters. He pulls back. What has happened to your face?
You don't approve?
No.
I grin. This is what I normally look like. His mouth drops open. I put my sunglasses back on. Walk with me. He tucks his tea towel into his waistband and follows me out under the awning and into the square. I take his arm like we're just having a stroll.
I waited and waited. His eyes are full of tears. Then the police were there and all hell kicked off.
He wipes his nose on the back of his sleeve.
Did they pull you in?
He nods.
They were looking for you and Marcel. They saw you arrive, but then you vanished.
Yeah.
They put me in the back of a van and questioned me.
Did they do any damage?
He shakes his head.
Not really. A few bruises.
Amateurs.
I didn't tell them, Jack,
he says fiercely. I pat his arm. Good. We sit on the fountain and watch the glittering, sparkling waterfall. It reminds me of a square in Italy.
Where is Marcel?
He says. I watch the light dancing on the water. He didn't make it. He nods like it was what he thought.
Can I see you again?
He asks.
Yes.
His face lights up with disbelief. I shake my head, smiling. Not like that.
You don't want to go out with me?
I put my arm around his shoulders. Better than that. I want to offer you a job. I have one last place to visit. The pavement is all grey concrete and dried chewing gum, dusty in the heat. Madame Jojo's is closed for a siesta. The tabac is open, but I walk past. The 7-Eleven is empty. The green cross of the pharmacy glows across the street. The grill door is shut. I press the bell. The door buzzes. I walk down the corridor and into reception. He perches on his stool, still slightly awkward. He looks up and his eyes widen at the sight of me. A woman in a suit is not what he was expecting.
Hello, Henri.
I put my hands in my pockets, and when they come out, they are encased in metal. He stares. Shall we? I say. This has been an Audible Studios production of Winter Dark, written by Alex Callister and performed by Elle Potter. Copyright by Alex Callister, 2019. Production copyright 2019 by Audible Limited. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Limited.
We hope you enjoyed listening to Winter Dark. Now, listen to a sneak preview of the next book in the series, Winter Rising, which is available now to pre-order on Audible. After that, stay listening for an Audible Sessions interview with Elle Potter, the narrator of the series.
Winter Rising. Prologue. Day 14. The girl sat up and opened her eyes. She could see nothing, and it was disorientating. Which way was up and which way down? One minute she had been in a bar on her dream date, and the next minute she was here. Her senses strained into the dark, night air warm on her face, traffic far away, a feeling of space above. A wide open sky. She was sitting on hard ground, a hint of a breeze rustling long grass and leaves on trees. Why was it so dark? Her hands flew to her eyes, scrabbling at the lids. Lashes fluttered under her fingers. There should be some light. Even in the middle of the night, London never got completely dark. She had heard you could see the sodium from space. Nothing. Her heart thudded as the panic hit. She lunged out and her fingers hit something hard, stone covered in leaves. Ivy. She could smell its bitterness. There was carving on the stone. Old writing. The ivy was growing right over the top. A gravestone. Instinct forced her body still, choked the scream rising up her throat. She froze, listening to the rustling in the trees, the faraway traffic, the hammer, hammer, hammering of her heart, and something else. A sound like a blade on a whetstone. A slow, rhythmic scrape. She felt the echo of something long known and only just recognised. The shape of a story. She was part of a narrative that had played out 100 times before. Hello, she wanted to say. Is there anyone there? The sound, like a blade on a whetstone, stopped. She fumbled at her pocket, and her fingers touched the smooth screen of her phone. A while ago, when she had started internet dating, she had signed up to the ICE app, the In Case of Emergency panic app. One press and a message was sent. She had never had to use it before. She jabbed at the screen again and again in the pitch dark. She could make out nothing, not even a glimmer from the homepage. Had her phone run out of battery? Someone was standing in front of her. She could feel them in the air. Who are you? She said. I am Firestorm, the voice said. Fear held her stiff as a board. She knew Firestorm. Everyone did. Even though she had heard the words, she still couldn't make sense of them. Someone has taken out a contract on me, she whispered. She couldn't believe it. Who cared enough to want her dead? No, said the voice. You are an experiment. The first of 12. Now we are entering the final countdown. She could make nothing of this. What countdown? Her frightened brain skittered back to the question. Who are you? She said again. I am the guardsman. Day 12. In Paris, a judge sat down heavily on the toilet, in the end cubicle of the judge's bathroom, and wondered what a life spent in perpetual fear was doing to his insides. He had grown up with stories of Falcone and Borsellino, the selfless Italian magistrates that had stood up to the Sicilian mafia. As a young man, he had been fired with the spirit of emulation and developed a burning ambition to follow in their footsteps. Now he had got his wish, and the reality was not glorious or heroic. It was terrifying. He sometimes wondered what his old heroes would make of organized crime now. More powerful than any country, and backed up by the might of the Firestorm website. An assassination market that had moved off the dark web and become mainstream. The judge remembered seeing Firestorm for the first time, and staring while his colleagues laughed. Welcome to Firestorm. Cheating husband? Bitch wife? Hate your boss? Let Firestorm take care of your problem. Safe, anonymous, cheap. The judge hadn't laughed. He had been too busy considering the implications. By its first birthday, Firestorm had chalked up more than 50,000 contracts, and a whole new industry had been born. It passed 100,000 a few months later, and by then its potential for intimidation had been realized. If you care, your enemies have all the leverage they need. The judge knew he should be glad that his parents were dead, and that he had no wife and children to be afraid for. But he felt alone and tired and fearful. He was afraid for himself, and that made him ashamed, but no less afraid. The guardsmen will find you soon, he had been told. He looked at the grey, industrial toilet partition and the grey, hard-wearing floor, and wondered what would happen if he never came out. The guardsmen could probably find him even here, in the judge's toilets in the Palais de Justice. The judge thought about the guardsman, Firestorm's most celebrated contractor. He was just a man, the judge told himself, just an ordinary man. And that was part of the problem. The guardsman could walk into a bar and order a drink right beside you, and you would never know. The knife in the back you never saw coming. The outside door to the corridor creaked. The judge sat very still, listening in the suddenly full silence. Someone was standing right outside his cubicle. He could hear them breathing. It was strange there hadn't been any footsteps. There was a tap, tap, tap. The kind of sound made by metal, not knuckles. The kind of sound a blade might make if it was tapping lightly on a thin partition door. Hello? He said. The cubicle door crashed open, shattering the feeble lock. The door bounced off the partition wall and closed again. No shoes. That explained the silence. The door creaked slowly open again. It wasn't going to be in the back. Day 8. A man walked into a bar. The barmaid checked him out as she worked the pump. Women were always checking him out. Up and down went her lashes, her mouth pursing as she finessed the head on a pint. A flick of brown hair along the bar caught his attention. A woman on her own. Desperate. He could read it in her body language. She was on the phone, laughing too loudly and sending flirty little glances around the room. Easy, the man thought. She was Australian, and it didn't take more than 2 martinis to have her spilling her life story, crossing and uncrossing her long legs on the bar stool. She had come to London as a student and never left. Her skirt rose mid-thigh as she shifted again. The man laughed. He could feel his knife, newly sharpened, pressing into his side. "Because of our fabulous weather," he said. "Because of the fabulous men," she replied. And he knew it was a done deal. She didn't mention her husband, but that was fine because the man already knew all about him, and in fact had had a long and detailed exchange with him in Firestorm's online contract room. The TV above the bar was showing a city in flames. It could be any one of a dozen cities in North America. New York, Chicago, LA were all burning. The man couldn't have cared less. He checked his watch. No body,
the husband had stipulated, and that was fine too. The woman's face fell. She put her hand on his knee.
Do you have somewhere you need to be?
He could see her nipples through her thin blouse. He could taste her eagerness.
She touched her hand to her ring finger, unconsciously rubbing the skin. He opened the door to the rented house and breathed in deeply. The smell of old houses got him hard. He might start off outside, but in the end, this was where he always brought them. The woman hung on his arm, oblivious. She giggled as she stumbled on the hall carpet. She laughed as he closed the front door. He could smell apple martini on her breath.
Just a little bit further.
His heart rate was accelerating. He could feel his blade under his jacket, against his ribs. It pricked through the thin shirt, pricked against his skin. He knew when he took his jacket off there would be tiny specks of blood on the white. His hand was on the door. The room beyond was in darkness. She stumbled again, and giggled again, and then she was over the threshold, and he slammed the door behind him. Then he hit the lights. Plastic sheeting draped the walls, taped high and covering the floor, filling the room with the chemical smell of cellophane. A couch and a chair stood in the middle at exactly the right height. He would cut her first, and take her from behind while he watched her bleed. He pulled the knife from its sheath. Light played on the serrated blade, little dancing beads of brilliant white. This was his favourite bit. It was all good, but this bit, when they realised, was the best. He looked up. The woman stood leaning up against the far wall. She put her hand to the top of her head and pulled at her hair. A wig. Her real hair was as blonde as his own.
God, that thing is hot, she said, and her Australian accent was gone.
The man stared.
The woman tossed the wig aside and put her hands in her pockets. When they came out, they were wearing knuckle dusters.
Hi, she said. My name is Winter. Welcome to the last night of your life.
Chapter 1. I soak in the guardsman's surprise, fill myself up with the delicious, perfect shock of it. The most feared contract killer in history, Firestorm's top contractor, a cutter, a knife specialist. His body vibrates with halted momentum, the jolt of a gap where a step should be. Light reflects along the blade in his hand. His adrenaline is going full throttle. Only surprise is keeping him standing, and that won't last long.
I'm not worried. I may be all alone, but if I can't take an armed opponent one-on-one, I have no business being head of field. Not that I am unarmed. I just want to use my fists. For all GCHQ's technology, I have been punching air. Until now. Until I booked the guardsman for a hit on myself.
I would like her to suffer,
I had told the guardsman, posing as my own husband in Firestorm's online contract room.
It will be my pleasure, he had replied.
I lever myself off the wall by my shoulder blades. A picture of a girl bleeding out in a dusty graveyard fills my head. Her name was Lucy. I can see her now, hunched, half lying against a gravestone, the ICE app lit up on her phone. I can see myself running through the dark, tearing down the overgrown paths. I can feel her, sticky, in my arms, feel the grass, dry as straw, feel the dust beneath me as I hauled her onto my body, trying to get her off the ground, trying to lessen the contact between dirt and missing skin. She was alive. Alive long enough for me to find.
The guardsman, she said to me,
and something else. And then she died. It took 3 burly ambulance crew to prise me away from her. They put me in the back of an ambulance with a blanket. They pressed some hot, sweet drink on me like I was a civilian, and through the open door I could see her lying between the graves, abandoned in the dirt. And I broke away from the gentle hands and lurched out of the ambulance and gathered her in my arms again, while forensics screamed and scene of crime officers cursed my name. I clench my fists and clench my jaw, and the blackness rises. The guardsman stares at me. I breathe the darkness in, draw it around me, wrap myself in it like a mantle. His mouth opens. Here it comes. What will it be? Who are you? What's going on? Did the guardsman send you? He says. Is this some kind of test? What? Who are you? He says. Are you a contractor? Do you work for the guardsman? No, I say. I really don't. We stare at each other. I can see his brain ticking. His lips move as if he's working something out. His face twists in confusion. Something is wrong, and indecision makes him rock like a metronome. Smart would open the door and run like hell. Stupid will carry on as if nothing has changed. I can already tell which way he's going to go. This is not Firestorm's top contractor. This is not the person I booked. Where is the guardsman? He tenses with coiled momentum, telegraphing his move. Behind him, the door slams open, smacking him in the back. What the hell? The contractor staggers forward, and a slim Chinese girl strides into the room. She is wearing dungarees, Doc Martens, and a murderous expression. She sizes the contractor up through narrowed eyes, then swings sideways and lands a stinging heel strike on the back of his neck. He keels over, face first. The newcomer kicks the fallen contractor. Plenty of welly. Take that, motherfucker! She says, her accent straight from southeast London. I blink. Don't worry, she says. I'm here to save you. You are going to be fine. Great, I say. I would have been here earlier, she says, but I dropped my Oyster card in his front garden. She pats her huge pockets as if to check she still has it. I kneel down beside the body, 2 fingers on the jugular. Nothing. I pick up the wrist. Still nothing. Shit. Fuck, will you look at this place? She says, taking in the specialist decor. She pulls at a dungaree buckle. The strap is slipping off her shoulder. I roll the body over. Grey eyes stare at the ceiling. What are you doing here? Were you following me? I saw his account. She nudges the body with her boot. I knew he was on a job. I am up and in her face before she can move. You hacked Firestorm! She shrugs. And? I get her by the scruff of the neck and haul her out the door, along the hall and into the front garden. And I want to talk to you, I say. Chapter 2. Simon glares at me. His gaze sweeps the Chinese girl, then returns to me. His hair looks like he'd just got out of bed, but then it always does. He folds his arms. As the orange streetlight catches his face, I see his lips tight over his anger. The night is quiet. Traffic from the nearby Lewisham High Road. Maybe the odd fox. Otherwise, nothing. He's dead, he says to me. My eyes slide across to my would-be rescuer. Self-defense. Entrapment. Simon glares some more. Are you honestly expecting the Met to believe you just bumped into this guy? Somewhere, a fox shrieks. Simon scowls. Please, Winter, I understand, but we talked about this. You have to stop doing this alone. I pat my quartermaster's arm. It wasn't him anyway. An image of Lucy bleeding out in a dusty graveyard fills my head. Disappointment soaks through me. I push it away, close it down. Simon's scowl deepens.
Are you out of your mind? He hisses. You tried entrapment on the guardsman.
It's my turn to scowl. Does he think I'm not up to the guardsman? We glare off under the orange streetlight. A siren sounds in the distance, getting closer. Both of us have forgotten the teenager. She looks from Simon to me and back again, her dark eyes tracking to and fro like she's watching tennis. Her cute oval face is baffled. She puts her hands in her outsized pockets. My head aches. Weeks of monitoring the police channels and the ICE app are catching up with me. So, I say, tell me about hacking Firestorm, the website we have teams and teams of analysts trying to take down. I didn't exactly hack it, she says. I didn't think you did. I saw his phone outside the bar. You saw Firestorm on his phone? Yeah. I narrow my eyes. How, exactly? She looks round at the street, then at Simon. It's a bit awkward. I fold my arms. Go on. I lifted his phone. She fiddles with a dungaree strap. So you saw he was on a job and you thought you would just pop along and stop it? Yeah, she says. It didn't occur to you to tell someone? To get help? One guy? Please. She looks insulted. I could have taken him with my hands behind my back. She thinks about this. Blindfolded. I consider the youthful vigilante in silence. Who the fuck are you people anyway? She says. I'm glad you asked me that. I look down at her. She reminds me of myself about 100 years ago. She reminds me of myself when I didn't care. Her name is Zhu, and she is third generation. Her grandparents ran a takeaway. Her parents are doctors. She holds a black belt in karate and trains at the Zendo Kickboxing Center in Finsbury Park. She is in her second year at the LSE studying financial accounting, and she is as bored as fuck. Her words. So you want to be an accountant? Fuck no, she says. My mum wants me to be an accountant. I meet Simon's eyes over the top of her head. She turned up to stop a hit with nothing but her fists and an Oyster card. What? She says. Have you ever considered an alternative career? The Guardsman. The Guardsman watched as the trainee contractor woke up on the cellar floor and put his hands to his face. The chains around the trainee's ankles clinked.
Hello, said the trainee. Is this another test?
His head was moving in little jerky movements like he was searching for something. No, it was not another test. There would be no more tests for this trainee. He had failed to meet the required standard, and the guardsman did not tolerate mediocrity. Luckily, he fulfilled all the criteria for something else. The trainee's hands started to shake. He scrabbled at his face.
What have you done to me?
He whispered. The guardsman glanced at the shipping boys squatting against the cellar walls. In the dim light from the single hanging bulb, they looked almost alive. You are an experiment, said the guardsman, the second of 12. Now we are entering the final countdown. It is an honor. The trainee looked like he didn't understand, which was fine by the guardsman. The graveyard had been a success, and the enclosed cellar had also been a complete success, which meant the trainee contractor was now surplus to requirements. The guardsman looked down at the knife and felt the anticipation rise. Whetstone, then dry stone, then polish. Was it sharp enough? Maybe it needed doing again. That was the problem with knife work. Sometimes you had to sharpen the blade 3 or 4 times during a job. Not that the guardsman objected to that particularly. The guardsman stepped forward and smiled as the screaming started. There was purity in extreme pain. Who was it that had said that? Was it Freud, or was it Nietzsche? There was a knock at the door. The guardsman frowned.
"We have a problem," said the voice behind the door at the top of the cellar stairs.
"What?" snapped the guardsman, sliding the bolt and opening the door. There had been too many problems recently. 22 failed contracts in 8 weeks, and every day it felt like something was pushing, prodding, testing the firestorm defences.
"Tonight's job. The one you sent contractor 159 to. You were right."
The guardsman followed the man through to the room with the banks of screens.
"The system has thrown up a partial facial match on the target."
The guardsman leaned forward and pulled up the live surveillance feed. A bar, as expected. Blonde wood, widescreen TV, contractor 159, the guardsman's go-to contractor, the light shining off his golden hair. The guardsman hated being right. The blonde contractor shifted slightly, and the target came into view. The guardsman stared at the woman with the brown hair. She didn't look familiar.
"Who does the system think it is?"
The man with the strange eyes, blue on the left and green on the right, closed the door and pointed at the life-size photo nailed to the back of it. There were holes in the picture, like someone had been using it for target practice. The guardsman stared at the photo of the familiar face, the bright green eyes, the blonde hair, the distant stare. Public enemy number one.
"Winter." The name hissed out before the guardsman could stop it. The government agent responsible for unmasking the boss 8 weeks ago. All of a sudden, the weeks of sly prodding and testing were making more sense. Winter. Reckless, arrogant, and unbelievably effective. If it hadn't been for Firestorm's anomaly software, it would have been the guardsman in that bar. The algorithms had picked up a discrepancy, and the guardsman had fielded a substitute and a fleet of surveillance cameras. Rage rose, along with frustration. Winter was one of the few people on the planet with special protected status on Firestorm. Untouchable. Untouchable because the boss wanted to do it himself. And he had to do it himself. Everyone knew she had tracked him down. He had to assert his authority. The world of organized crime was in crisis. North America was in open revolt and, thanks to Winter, the boss was being hunted to the ends of the earth, not able to stay in one place for more than a few hours, not able to impose his authority where it was needed. The guardsman thought about the boss, forced underground like a mole in the dark. There was sobbing coming up through the floorboards. It was getting louder. The guardsman turned to look at the picture of Winter. How the guardsman would love to have her, right now, chained to the floor in the cellar, instead of some trainee. A vein throbbed under the guardsman's eye. How could anyone think with all that noise going on? The guardsman opened the door and went back down the cellar stairs. The trainee contractor stopped sobbing at the sound of footsteps. His head jerked backwards and forwards like he was searching. "Please," said the trainee, "just shoot me." The guardsman frowned at the suggestion. Did the man know nothing? The guardsman never used firearms, had never even held a gun. The boss, on the other hand, was all about guns. Quick,
efficient and low risk. The thought of Alec Constantine and his efficiency focused the guardsman, and a moment later, the trainee contractor crumpled to the floor.
"Get out," said the guardsman, without looking round, and the man with the strange eyes hurried out, closing the door behind him. Firestorm was a sacred trust, and the guardsman, as its administrator, was here to protect it. Winter had challenged the boss. She could not be allowed to do the same to Firestorm, particularly not now, not when they were so close, 8 days away. The guardsman stared at the picture on the back of the door. Maybe it was time to meet her. You couldn't really understand someone until you looked into the whites of their eyes, until you were close enough to feel their breath on your face. On the live feed from the bar, Winter and Contractor 159 were heading for the door. What to do? Winter had to suffer, that was for sure. One way or another.
We hope you enjoyed that taster of Winter Rising. You can pre-order it now from Audible. I'm Robin Morgan Bentley, and after Elle Potter, Audible's breakout star, finished narrating, I had a chance to speak to her. We talked about her training, her journey to becoming an actor, and the importance of queer narratives. So tell me a bit about yourself, because I know you're still at Lambda. So for people listening that don't know what Lambda is, just talk me through a bit about what you're doing with your life at the moment.
Yeah, so I'm at Lambda, which is the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art. I'm doing their postgrad course, which is a 2-year course. Very intense, 10 a.m. till 9 p.m. most days, doing a variety of, you know, voice movement kind of stuff. And there's a great screen and audio department as well. So that's how this sort of happened, I suppose, because we do quite a lot of audio stuff there.
So I guess some people go as, you know, you say people, oh, I'm going to go to drama school. For some people, that's their degree, essentially, and then they go there for 3 years as their grad. But for you, this is a post-grad course. Does that mean the focus of it is different to what that undergrad version would be?
No, because some post-grad courses at other drama schools are 1 year, and they are very different in structure. But the Lambda 2-year one, the reason why I loved it so much is because it's very similar to the 3-year course, and they just cram it all in. And you have to be kind of mad to do it, in a good way. It's also nice because it's just a good vibe, you know, because people on the course have sort of maybe been in the profession already and then are retraining, or they've done something else completely and then they've come to acting later in life. So it's a pretty diverse group of people.
And what about you and acting? Is it something that you, were you the kind of kid standing up and singing Tomorrow for Manny in front of everyone, or is it something you come to later?
Well, I didn't realise I was that kid at the time, but I think you look back and like teleologically link together the moments of your life where you realise you are becoming who you are. And looking back, yes, I was that kid. I did, you know, school plays and all that. Although mostly musical theatre, I think that's a lot of people's way in to acting. At least it was for me. I didn't do a real play until, a real play. That's bad, isn't it? People are always like, musical theatre is real. It is. Yeah. It is. I didn't do a play without music until I went to university, and that's when I started doing what some people would say is proper acting, capital P and a capital A.
It's interesting that you say a lot of people get into it via musical theatre. Is that just because it's kind of more appealing to kids, do you think?
Yeah, maybe. I think at my school, it's like there'd be the school musical every year, and it would be an endless like run of Fiddler on the Roof, then Sweeney Todd, Sound of Music, you know, like that's sort of the way in. We did an Arista Cats musical as well. I think it's sort of palatable. Either you don't get people going, we're gonna do
Antony and Cleopatra,
like Dr. Faustus, or although they did do that in sixth form at my school. My brother played Dr. Faustus.
Oh wow,
so,
pretty intense well for done. A 17-year-old, right?
Yeah,
so when you look back at those roles, which productions or which roles stick in your memory?
I think the main thing that sticks with me from stuff like that is the feeling that acting gives you when you're with people in the room, because there's really nothing else like it. It was really like, you know, people talk about the family, like the theatre family, you know, like you get really close to a cast, and like all the way through school, that was sort of my place, I suppose. Mm. The theatre kids kind of thing.
I guess everyone at school finds their thing, finds their community, finds where they feel comfortable. And for you, that was with the theatre clan.
I guess it was. It's weird looking back and like working out where it happened. Because I didn't, for a while, I didn't think I was going to be an actor, because I went to university first. I studied English at Oxford and I did a lot of singing there. I thought for a while I might do music college. Like I wanted to be an opera singer. I did, you know, lots of classical stuff. And then I suddenly realised that actually they're very different things. So I probably shouldn't compare them now. But for me, acting is like the more direct, like, way of expressing yourself.
It must feel like it's a profession, rather like, you know, wanting to be an author or wanting to be a footballer, where a lot of people must say, hey, you know, it's a really hard game to get into. Have you had a lot of that?
Yeah, well, I'm really lucky because my whole family is kind of quite artsy. My dad's a freelance TV director in like politics, not in artsy kind of stuff. But I think having a freelance kind of family means things sort of seem possible in a way that maybe they don't appear if you have a more kind of structured idea of what family life is like. And my mum's a piano teacher and all my family are musicians, and my older brother's an actor and the other brother's a musician. So it's quite a kind of artsy vibe. So they're very supportive. And it feels like my older brother sort of paving the way. It shows that it is possible to do it. Mm-hmm. But I think it definitely is like rocky. There's a certain amount of jeopardy in like pursuing something like this. But it just makes it even more satisfying, because it is a slightly insane thing to decide to do. But there must be a reason if you decide to do it. Like, it has to come from love of it. Otherwise, there'd be no point.
And how much are you able to draw on what you sort of studied at university, or even the productions you were in at university, mm-hmm. and still use that in your acting career now and going forward?
Well, actually, I'm so, so pleased I did an English degree, because firstly, just getting through a huge amount of text, like, and being able to read very quickly and sort through information really quickly. And I love reading. Like, I love fiction. I always have my head buried in a book. And so when the opportunity came around to do an audiobook, I was like, I basically read aloud to myself all the time anyway, so may as well do it like professionally. So yeah, the English degree has definitely helped. And it all accumulatively means the more breadth you have as an actor, so the more weird stuff you got involved in, like at uni or in drama school, then the kind of broader your repertoire of what you can access is, I suppose. So for an audiobook, you have to access, well, characters that are really far away from you, because it's just your voice, and somehow you have to play an Algerian taxi driver or a Russian undercover spy. Obviously, I have no idea what that's actually like, but the more your imagination has had to work in the past, then it becomes quite easy to kind of like build that world around you for yourself, and then for the whoever's listening, hopefully.
So talking of the Algerian taxi driver, yep. and all the other characters, tell me a little bit about how the process goes from you getting the manuscript, so uh-huh. Al, we'd love you to perform Winter Dog, uh-huh. to where we are now, the recording's in the bag, and we're talking about it afterwards. What's the process?
So, Vaz printed it, and it's a lot of paper. It's 406 A4 pages.
Although I noticed it was recycled paper, so that's,
yes,
that's good.
It was. Yeah. It was. I printed it at school because I can't pay for my own printing, that amount of stuff, and it's recycled paper, which we love to see. And then I realised straight away that I would need a huge amount of coloured pens, and I don't own a lot of coloured pens. So I went to Ryman's, and I bought loads of coloured pens, and I basically had a list of all the characters and information about those characters, like where they might be from and characteristics that might identify them. So floppy hair, glasses. So, you know, that might make me think maybe he's slightly nasal, or like how do the glasses sit on his face? How would that inform his physicality kind of thing? So any initial ideas in that first read, and also pronunciations and words I didn't know to look up later. So that's the first read. Second read was just another normal read, but then I penned in all the pronunciations. I know the phonetic alphabet, so that came in handy, writing all those down. And then my third read, That was when I used the coloured pens, assigned one for each character on my massive list. And also that read, I put in sort of articulation marks, maybe commas that weren't in, but that I would need for breathing or like emphasis. Because sometimes if you have a long sentence, you can get halfway through it and not actually know what you're saying. So every now and then just write in the margin what the point of that section is to help me find my way when I was doing it properly. Mm. And when we got to recording it in the booth, I was really thankful for the prep I'd done, because it's like past Elle had written tension here or dreamy dot dot dot. So it, you know, you kind of leave yourself a little map to follow when you come to doing the real thing.
I guess it must be hard to maintain consistency as well. If you've got a character that appears at the beginning of the book and then not again till towards the end, you've got to make sure that it's the same voice and the same tone and intonation and things at the end of the book, because otherwise the listener's going to be like, hang on.
Yeah, totally. You have to have a really clear image of who you are voicing. Because if you don't have an idea, then the listener is going to have no idea. If you're solid in it, then they'll remember. Like, if you remember a detail, remember the sound that you had, then they'll be with you. It was quite hard to voice, like, the male characters. There's quite a lot of male characters when Winter is in GCHQ, who have a sort of RP voice, like received pronunciation. It's initially tricky for me to find a masculine voice that wasn't just like homogenous, that wasn't just like exactly the same for everyone. So I had to mess around with like whether the voice is coming from the back of my throat or whether it's like really nasal down the front of it. So that was like a lot of fun. A lot of the prep work was just me sitting by myself
making funny noises.
Stupid noises. Like anyone who was watching me would have been like, what are you doing?
Yeah. I saw when you were in the booth, you were, even though, you know, it's focused on the voice, were you using your hands a lot? It was quite physical when you were recording. Does that help?
Yeah, it does, because one of the pieces of advice that one of our teachers at Lambda gave was that when you're doing an audiobook, you are standing next to your listener, pointing out things that they're seeing. And that image really helped me. So when there was like swathes of narration in Winter Dark, I'd use my hands to kind of pick out what I was seeing in front of me. Like, you do have to kind of paint it. I don't know if everyone does that, but it just felt natural to me to get into it physically, because then you're inhabiting it rather than just like using words that could mean anything. They have to be really specific to what you're trying to point out. Yeah.
And then for someone listening to this that is totally new to the world of Winter Dark, can you kind of introduce me to the world and to this character?
Yeah, so Winter Dark, the book, is set in the not too distant future, where basically the dark web has sort of come to the surface, and the stuff that we see as taboo now on the internet is not at all. So there's a contract killer site called Firestorm, which is essentially like eBay, but for contract killers. And the GCHQ team are trying to get to the bottom of who owns Firestorm, who the boss is. They call him the Prince of Darkness, so that they can shut down his website and also a branch of it called Slashstorm, which takes the idea of like X Factor style reality TV and applies it to killers, basically, where an assassin has 12 possible victims and the voting public basically decide who they save. So it plays on human emotions, basically, of who you want to survive. And so the idea is that it's set in this world where mindless killing is kind of much more normalised than it is now. Although the writer, Alex, said that it's really not that far away from us, this idea of everything's still in place, like the dark web exists, and it's really not too far in the future where like we could actually see stuff like that happening. And Winter, our protagonist, basically has to take down the guy who owns Firestorm, but she's also pretty attracted to him, so it's a really, really fun, exciting story. And Winter is just absolutely badass as well. She's a really, really cool, spy is the wrong word, agent, secret undercover agent, and she gets into lots of exciting situations.
As a female performer, do you relate to the depiction of women in this book?
She's definitely a strong female protagonist, which are three words we love to hear clumped together, but she's also she's got weaknesses and she's not, like, morally perfect. Like, you get Bond, like, womanizing people, and Winter is sort of a manizer and a womanizer as well. I love that she's queer as well. So I think that she is fulfilling the kind of strong female lead roles that we need more in literature at the moment. But she's also, she's got her imperfections, which I like, because the other side of the coin is that you have lots of female characters, but they're all kind of perfect and not relatable in any way. And I think Winter is not perfect, and that works to her advantage, I think.
So you think there's a risk of sort of caricature in this kind of pressure to write female characters? You could just find these unrealistic, flawless women who don't actually represent reality.
Yeah, and I think it's right that they are flawed, because everyone is.
They should be.
And, yeah, Winter acts impulsively a lot of the time and doesn't always think things through. She's incredibly intelligent and impulsive, but she makes mistakes.
I think when I first read the manuscript, the queerness of it and the queer characters, refreshing in its kind of boldness.
Yeah.
The very, very first words of the audiobook are sexually omnivorous. I guess that's important. I know there's been a lot of talk about assigning LGBT characteristics to characters after the fact. I don't know if you've seen
the J.K. Rowling stuff.
So I guess there's something in that about the boldness of writing characters, queer characters, and not having to do it retrospectively.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. And also, it's what I love is it's not actually really acknowledged in the book. Winter's sexuality is never explained. It's just sexually omnivorous. Like, she will sleep with whoever she wants and she doesn't have to label it. And I think, yeah, people like J.K. Rowling, jump on the bandwagon easily of retrospectively assigning queerness to their works. But they talk the talk, but they don't walk the walk. Whereas what Alex has done here is she's just got a woman who is not ashamed of her sexuality and not even bothered about defining what it is. Often at the moment, it's like queer narratives are about being queer. And this is a narrative which is about taking down global organized crime. And the main female character just happens to also be queer, which is great.
It's cool. It's the start of a series as well. I know at the end of the audiobook, there's a little sneak peek of Winter Rising, which is the next in the series. Where do you want to see Winter go next?
She's got a lot of power at the end of the book when we leave her. I'd love to see her sort of slide onto the dark side a little bit, because she definitely feels herself being pulled towards a different way of life, maybe away from the kind of mainstream GCHQ style agenting that she's been doing thus far. And I think I'd really like to see if her kind of moral compass is skewed. I'd quite like her to be a baddie, at least for a bit, and then maybe come back to the...
back to from, the Goodyear book tree.
Full circle.
And what about you, Al? Like, you're now towards the end of your time at Lambda, right? So what about... I know you've got something coming up at the Soho Theatre. Right?
Yes, so I write on the side of everything. I've got a two-woman show called Hotter. It's about hotness in every sense of the word. So Winter would probably like it. It's about blushing and sweating and pleasure and stuff like that. We interviewed 40 women and trans people for it. And just, it's all about what gets you hot, basically. We're at the Soho Theatre for a week at the beginning of May. And also it's been extended for a week in the middle of June as well, which is lovely.
Mm.
And I'm, working on another show with my writing partner. And then, Lambda stuff, basically.
So you're not bored. You've got a lot of stuff going on.
There's a lot on. But it's so exciting to be sort of starting in the real world now.
Are there certain things you'd love to achieve in your career, or you just kind of see how it goes?
Oh, that's a really good question, and one that probably will fill me with existential dread when I think about it later. I think I'm just riding the wave at the moment. I had no idea that I would do an audiobook, and I have loved it so much that it's made me think, what other opportunities could I never have imagined I would do? What other ones are going to come up and totally change something about my life? So, I don't really have any milestones. I'm just going to see what comes as it happens.
Oh, it's so good to talk to you, and see you soon for book two and more stuff, I'm sure.
Yeah, can't wait.
Great.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Audible Sessions podcast with Al Potter.
Search Audible Sessions on the Audible website or on the app for interviews with more of your favourite narrators and authors.